Today on Wings.
How do we really know that nonviolent resistance is more effective or as effective as armed rebellion?
Why civil resistance works, the strategic logic of nonviolent conflict.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Erica Chenoweth directs the Nonviolent Action Lab at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. Chenoweth and Maria Stephan researched and published an empirical study titled Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. Carol Boss of Peace Talks Radio interviewed Chenoweth about their work.
So, Erica Chenoweth, give us some quick basics for listeners. What is civil, also called nonviolent resistance?
Nonviolent resistance is a set of coordinated techniques that can be applied in conflict when unarmed civilians actively confront an opponent using a variety of techniques like strikes, boycotts, protests, stay-aways, go-slows, and the like, in order to produce political or social change.
Erica, you wound up delving into research on nonviolent resistance, and for someone who had considered being in the military and was working on her PhD in security studies, what was the impetus for you to study and compare violent rebellions with nonviolent campaigns?
The impetus was more or less an accidental meeting with my soon-to-be co-author, Maria Stephan. We both were at a workshop in June of 2006 that was put on by the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, trying to convince social scientists like me to take nonviolent resistance seriously in the classroom. And when they were talking about cases of nonviolent resistance successes, I couldn't help but think of Tiananmen Square, the Hungarian uprising, and many other examples that I had learned about, where I thought nonviolent resistance had failed disastrously. So toward the end of the workshop, Maria and I spoke about how do we really know that nonviolent resistance is more effective or as effective as armed rebellion? We can't know that just by pulling out case studies where we think nonviolent resistance has worked. We have to use some kind of systematic comparison of nonviolent and violent resistance campaigns and look at their outcomes. So the study was really derived out of a series of conversations that I had as a skeptic with this woman, Maria, who was herself maybe more of an optimist. But we developed a research design where we looked from 1900 to 2006 worldwide at every known example where people had used nonviolent resistance to either remove an incumbent leader from power or to achieve territorial independence through secession or through the expulsion of a military occupation or colonial power. And we compared them against their violent counterparts. And that's basically where the research came from. What we found, of course, is that the nonviolent campaigns succeeded twice as often as the violent ones. And they also achieved significant material concessions, such as autonomy or the forcing of competitive elections more than twice as often as their violent counterparts.
So if you could be more specific, why the differences in results between violent and nonviolent tactics?
Well, we drilled down into the data. We had hundreds of cases to compare. We looked at the characteristics of violent and nonviolent campaigns and found that the nonviolent campaigns had one thing that really differentiated them from the violent ones, and that was their sheer size. So nonviolent campaigns tend to be about 11 times larger on average as a proportion of the overall population compared with violent insurgencies. They are just way bigger, and their sheer size allows them to activate all kinds of political dynamics that put pressure on the security forces, economic elites, business elites, educational authorities, cultural authorities, and the like to reevaluate their own interests in the long term. And that starts to pull those pillars of support away from their loyalty to the opponent. So basically, nonviolent resistance allows popular campaigns to get really big because there are many lower barriers to participation, and that's what allows them to be so politically powerful.
Well, you make reference in your book to people power movements and the people power movement in the Philippines in the 80s. Tell us about some of the factors that made this an impressive example of successful nonviolent resistance.
Part of the reason it's so striking is because there had been long-standing violent insurgencies in the Philippines for decades before the people power movement made its appearance on the scene. What happened is a classic example of an authoritarian regime assassinating a powerful political opponent and cutting short his potential to challenge the existing status quo. This act backfired, and hundreds of thousands or even millions of people around the country coalesced in a large-scale uprising that brought together Catholics, that brought together leftists, intellectuals, students, labor unions, the middle class. It cut across ethnicity, class, and religious affiliation. And so it really was this burst of popular mobilization. One of the key features of the people power movement was that it featured not only large-scale mass demonstrations, which many people think of as an iconic example of nonviolent resistance, but it also featured things like non-cooperation, stay-aways, general strikes, boycotts. And these techniques, in addition to large-scale demonstrations, really allowed the movement to diversify its pressure points. So the military defected, the internal security forces defected, many business and economic elites defected. Ultimately, even Ferdinand Marcos' external sponsor and ally, the U.S. government under Ronald Reagan, withdrew support from the regime.
Lots of people think of Serbia as well, where nonviolent resistance was quite successful.
Yes, yeah, Serbia is another iconic example. And ultimately, it's a great example of how a large and growing diverse set of social actors can build power from below and contest a very repressive regime. There was a large coalition built from a student movement called OTPOR together with a number of different opposition political parties that formed a coalition called DOS. And they were able to contest fraudulent elections under Slobodan Milosevic through people power. The structure of that movement was very localized. People could join into the movement by basically committing to a few core principles of nonviolent action and the singular goal of removing Milosevic through competitive elections. And they used demonstrations, boycotts, lots of street humor, lots of performance art that really mobilized the population into understanding that there was a viable alternative and that they could have something to do with bringing it about. Ultimately, toward the end of September of 2000, there were elections held in that country that were clearly fraudulent. This was discovered through an organized monitoring network that OTPOR had set up. They were the ones that detected the fraud and publicized it. And hundreds of thousands of people descended on Belgrade to basically defend the outcome of the election, which was that the opposition candidate had indeed won handily in the first round, and forced Milosevic to leave. And one of the really interesting insights that everyone was able to glean from that case was that indeed the security forces were ordered to shoot on the unarmed demonstrators. We know this because the activists themselves had stolen their radios and could hear the order come down. And none of the security forces followed the order. Afterward, when many of them were interviewed, they explained that a primary reason why they didn't shoot was that they thought their kids might be in the crowd, or they thought their neighbor's kids might be in the crowd, or they saw someone they recognized, and they didn't basically want to go down with the ship. So really importantly, this wasn't a matter of melting the hearts of a brutal dictator or even melting the hearts of the agents, the security agents. It was more a matter of giving them an opportunity to think about what their own long-term future would look like in this country based on their behavior right now. And many of them made the crucial choice to basically not go down with the ship. And we see that happening time and time again. When these movements get very large and when they become quite representative and diverse, that these pillars of support refuse to cooperate long-term with the opponent.
This is Carol Boss, and I'm talking today with Erica Chenoweth, author of Why Civil Resistance Works. Well, it doesn't always work. I mean, there have been some failures. Are there any on the top of your mind that you can give us the reasons why they didn't succeed?
Sure. There are many examples where nonviolent resistance has failed. There are certainly many examples where violent resistance has failed as well. The ones at the top of my mind for nonviolent resistance are cases like Iran in 2009 and Burma in 2007. Many people will point to those two as iconic failures. The 2007 and 1998 uprisings in Burma show us a few really important things. The first is that when the campaign remains largely urban, leftist intellectuals and students, and doesn't really expand out to other bases of support among the poor, among the rural classes, and among different ethnic and social categories in the country, it's often unlikely that the campaign has the growth potential in terms of the numbers that it needs to succeed. The second thing we learn is that when there's over-reliance on techniques such as demonstrations, rather than flexibility and innovation of new techniques like boycotts and stayaways and other methods of dispersion, these movements become a little bit predictable. And the predictability of them makes it easier for the opponent to suppress them. And then the third thing would simply be the inability of these movements to create meaningful defections within those pillars of support. So economic elites, business elites, security forces didn't defect, mainly because the movements never became kind of rural-based or diverse enough to force that crucial self-interested choice within those pillars of support.
I think you found in your studies that nonviolent campaigns and strategies contributed more than violent campaigns to the transition to a peaceful democracy.
Yes, we absolutely did find that countries that emerge from nonviolent struggles are about 10 times more likely to emerge with democratic institutions compared with those that emerge from armed struggles. And they're also about 15% less likely to relapse into civil war within 10 years compared to countries emerging from armed struggles. So yes, these nonviolent campaigns have been more likely to achieve their immediate goals, removal of an incumbent leader or territorial independence, but they are also more likely to bring forth more democratic, more peaceful societies in the longer term.
Just out of curiosity, how soon into your studies did you start seeing some of their patterns? I heard you say in a talk that you gave that you used to think that nonviolent resistance was well-intentioned but dangerously naive. And I think you said, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that power flows from the barrel of a gun.
Right.
Were you shocked and startled by the results that you were coming up with?
Yes. I mean, the data collection lasted from the time Maria and I met in June of 2000 until early 2008. And then we wrote our first article based on the results. So it was sometime early 2008 when I ran the initial analysis and was pretty surprised to find that the nonviolent resistance campaigns were outperforming the violence ones. That was not my expectation. I thought at best they would be equivalent and probably more likely that the nonviolent campaigns would be less successful. So I was really surprised, and it took me a while to figure out why that was going on. It completely turned on its head most of the education that I'd had about what makes movements powerful. And it also turned on its head a lot of basic assumptions that I think we have, not just in my field, but in human society in general about where power comes from. And I think a lot of people buy into the dictum that power flows from the barrel of a gun, that it's basically monolithic, that it's basically constantly replenishing itself. There's no possible way for people to affect change in their societies. And those types of approaches became something that I think I would just buy into without having examined the evidence.
So everything that you said today sounds like nonviolent strategies directly contribute to peace.
Yeah, I think that's not always the case, that nonviolent campaigns directly contribute to peace, but it's certainly more likely when we look at the probabilities. You know, sometimes nonviolent resistance fails, but we find even in cases where it fails, it's more likely to, in the longer term, be followed by democratic reform and more peaceful societies. Now, in terms of positive peace and other measures of justice, that hasn't been fully interrogated yet, and I think that's a huge area for future research.
On Wings, Carol Boss of Peace Talks Radio is interviewing Erica Chenoweth, co-author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. Their newest book, published in 2021, is Civil Resistance, What Everyone Needs to Know.
Let's turn to our country, the USA. Do you think that nonviolent resistance has a kind of an image problem in our country?
Well, I think nonviolent resistance has an image problem in a lot of places. Maria and I generally use the term civil resistance because we find that it has less baggage than using the term nonviolent resistance, where people immediately assume you're arguing from a moral position rather than a strategic or politically efficacious position. I think part of that is nomenclature. Part of it is just sheer misunderstanding about the power of nonviolent resistance. Some people would critique the term civil resistance in part because they think it's too far afield from nonviolent resistance. And many people do think that the nonviolent element and the moral element has to be included. There's still a controversy about what to call this thing that we see happening in the world. And many people actually argue that both civil and nonviolent resistance are inadequate terms because they suggest that it's always a reaction. It's always a self-defensive resisting of an opponent. And many people actually prefer the term nonviolent action because that can be self-initiated and it doesn't depend on an oppressive environment. It can be done in any environment. And, you know, people are taught in school that, you know, Gandhi and King were just wonderful human beings who had very admirable moral qualities and behavior, but that, you know, they both got assassinated and neither of them really ended up getting what they wanted in the end. So the nice guys finish last. and we celebrate warfare. We celebrate our war heroes much more, even when, you know, they fail. It's kind of a strange double standard that occurs with talking about nonviolent resistance. And in many progressive or radical communities, nonviolent resistance is a dirty word because it is equated with passivity or pacification. And there's, you know, arguments out there that nonviolence helps the state because people are not really willing to engage in truly militant radical action, and therefore the state wins. I think both of these perspectives that are very skeptical about nonviolent resistance are just not supported in the empirical record at all.
Erica Chenoweth, if we can talk about the success or non-success of nonviolent resistance in movements and campaigns in the U.S., currently, for example, Occupy Wall Street, more currently Black Lives Matter, the successful effort to take down the Confederate flag in South Carolina as examples?
Yes, absolutely. My sense on Occupy is that Occupy Wall Street hasn't totally failed. I think that there are a few things that are quite different in American society after that movement, one of which is that economic inequality is top of the agenda of both political parties in a way. Even though they have different solutions they're promoting, everybody has to talk about it if they want to be taken seriously in this country. That's something that's never been the case. The second thing is that many of the people that are now quite active in mobilization toward Black Lives Matter, toward the environmental movement, and many other of the very skilled movements that we see in this country cut their teeth in the Occupy movement, meaning that they first met there and they actually learned a lot of valuable lessons about how to do nonviolent resistance and how not to do it. And the third thing is that part of the lesson of Occupy, and a cautionary lesson, is that many Occupy groupings, which were quite localized, committed to nonviolent resistance at the outset. And New York was one of them. But many of them didn't. And they became really entangled in this conversation around diversity of tactics, explicitly meaning should people be allowed to engage in more disruptive kind of property damage, violent action or self-defensive action that involved some level of violence, and should they be allowed to do that? And I think that that conversation really distracted the movement and actually alienated a lot of potential third-party supporters in a way that provides a lot of really valuable cautionary lessons for movements going forward in this country. Black Lives Matter, I'm loath to comment on ongoing movements, in fact, in part because I think that when we do comment on them, we may or may not have influence on how they transpire. But what I'll say is, knowing what we know about what prior movements historically have done to succeed, there are these four things. The first is that they expand the numbers of people participating and their diversity. So the more diverse the participants and the larger the group, the more likely the campaign is to succeed. The second thing is that movements that succeed tend not to rely on single tactics like demonstrations. They tend to do other types of really innovative and creative techniques that draw more people in, while also maintaining pressure against the opponent. The third thing that they tend to do is they tend to maintain nonviolent discipline in the face of brutality from the opponent. And the fourth thing that they do is they begin to create shifts in the loyalty and the cooperation of people in those pillars of support. So in this country, that would mean police, Congress people, state legislatures, people in powerful positions in the business and economic community, and national leadership. And from what I can tell, Black Lives Matter is actively performing on all four of those dimensions as we speak. So I'll leave it to people who are involved in the movement to talk about the challenges that they face going forward.
So after the publication of your book a few years ago, what kind of impact have you seen? That's a very broad question. For example, would be interesting to know if there was a response from the military, from people in the military.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I had no idea how many people would be interested in Maria's and my book when it came out. That the average academic book, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education, is read by 7 people. So we didn't really expect it to be read so widely, and I certainly didn't expect people to read it as a prescriptive book. But nevertheless, it's had a much wider readership, especially among practitioners of all kinds. The activist communities here in the United States and abroad have been interested in our findings, and I hear them kind of reverberating around a lot of different, especially progressive communities around the United States. At the same time, international activists often express interest in it, and at times, to tell you the truth, there's some gratitude because the conversation about whether to use nonviolent or violent resistance is fundamental to most social movements operating, especially in repressive regimes. And many people who have the intuition that nonviolent resistance is the most efficacious way forward for them find our book useful in supporting their argument. And I wouldn't say that anybody is using the book to motivate a social movement that wouldn't otherwise have taken place. But I think that the people who want to make the argument that they want to stay nonviolent find the findings useful. And then in terms of sort of government interest in it, I mean, Maria ended up going into the State Department right after we published the book. And she was in the State Department when the book came out, and she was working in Afghanistan, and then she was redeployed to work with the Syrian opposition. And I think that because of this, there's been a lot of policy interest. She's been able to, really spread the message within the U.S. foreign policy establishment, certainly with my contacts in various levels of government. There's also been interest, and there's a surprising amount of acceptance on the behalf of uniformed military that nonviolent resistance is effective, that it is effective because of political reasons. And they see this as something that comes across very intuitively for them because it's simply a matter of learning how to overcome adverse conditions with a skilled set of mechanisms and tactics. And that makes sense to uniformed military. I'd say the most reluctant or resistant of sort of government officials that I've come into contact with over the years are civilian defense officials. They tend to be very dismissive of the work.
What about response from law enforcement agencies, for example?
I haven't heard too much from law enforcement, to tell you the truth. And I think part of that's just because I don't work in local communities very much. Most of my interaction is either in academic circles or to some extent in sort of DC circles. But I'd be interested to know, actually, if it is being read by law enforcement and what their take is.
You and your co-author Maria Steven wrote in your book that after completing your research, you both had confidence that nonviolent resistance was not only possible but also perfectly viable as a strategy for removing authoritarian regimes and achieving self-determination almost anywhere in the world. I wanted to ask you, since your book was published, we're witnessing many horrific acts of violence worldwide. Do you still remain optimistic about the future of nonviolent resistance?
I do remain optimistic about the future of nonviolent resistance, and part of the reason is because at the same time that we're witnessing horrific violence visited upon dissidents and civilians alike in several parts of the world, we're also seeing the greatest explosion of onsets of nonviolent campaigns worldwide that we've ever seen before. And it's kind of an irony that at the same time we see in the news all kinds of horrific accounts of violence, we're also living in one of the most contentious nonviolent periods in human history, on record at least. I've been updating my data to sort of count the new onsets of nonviolent campaigns, and it's kind of stunning that just in the 5 years from 2010 to 2015, we've witnessed more new onsets of nonviolent mass civil disobedience campaigns than we saw during the entire 1990s as the Soviet Union was falling apart. And certainly those movements had much to do with that. So I think that, there's good news and bad news. The good news is nonviolent resistance is on the rise, and violent insurgency is declining and going out of style in a major way, except in a couple parts of the world. And the bad news is just that, as these types of techniques become more routine, that certainly means that authoritarian regimes have a chance to catch up as well and develop innovative techniques for repression. And we've started to see a few of those in Russia and elsewhere, but that's kind of a natural adaptation. That doesn't mean that these campaigns are over. It just presents a new challenge for many of them to overcome.
Erica Chenoweth, Ph.D., directs the Nonviolent Action Lab at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. Among their works are Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, and Civil Resistance, What Everyone Needs to Know. Chenoweth and Zoe Marks are planning a book about the impact of women's participation on the outcomes of mass movements and the mass movements' impacts on women. Wings thanks Carol Boss and Peace Talks Radio for the use of this interview. To hear this program again or request a link to the full 39-minute interview, email wings@wings.org. Our recent programs are archived at wingsradio.org/wordpress. We also post at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings supporters include your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy, and host of events at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.